bring this meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start with the testimony. So we are on Waters, and either Deputy Commissioner or Director Lacasmo, whichever wants to start.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, my name again is Mark Olson, Deputy Commissioner of DNR. We finished yesterday with the overview of the Division of Waters. Unless there's any questions to that particular division, we can start in on the finance numbers as it relates to this particular division. Members, if you turn to page 83 within your budget book, you will see the budget recommendations. The Division of Waters is one of those divisions within the agency that is, as you saw yesterday, is virtually entirely relegated to the general fund for its funding stream. It has a number of permits, water use permits, and those activities, but those permits are, for the most part, canceled to the general fund, and the general fund then reestablishes or refunds the Division of Waters. There is no direct relationship to the fees and those funds for the division. There is, under the governor's recommendation, a request or a recommendation for a $52,000 reduction in general fund spending to the Division of Waters. If you remember last year, during the budget debates, this was also one of the highlighted items that we had brought to the committee or to the legislature last year. We have, through cost savings in our activities with the Attorney General's office, we have achieved cost savings across the entire agency, but particularly for the Division of Waters, we've been able to articulate a $52,000 reduction in spending. This has already occurred in the 05 spending reduction, so I just want to let the members know that that has already occurred. So here he's just recommending this being a reduction there. Members, the change items, we might as well just start in with the change items and start talking about those particular activities, being that general fund reduction of $52,000 is the only real recommendation we have. So I would ask you, unless there are specific questions from this page, to turn to page 65 of your budget book. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members, the first one is a $2,000 increase to the general fund. This is from a policy bill that is coming through the legislature or being introduced, dealing with administrative penalty orders. I'm sure the committee will be, if it makes it through, I believe it has done.
Yeah.
It has made it through policy. It's on to local government. The bill will be before the committee, and we can talk about those issues there, but it has a general fund expectation of $2,000. Again, this does not go to the Division of Waters. The next item is on page 66. This is an item of surcharge on summer use water. When we are looking at summer use water patterns, it is the recommendation that we put an additional surcharge of $20 per million gallons of usage to municipalities. Currently, if we measure or determine the fee based upon winter usage of your water use, so for your drinking, your cleaning, what you use there, what we're recommending is then taking a look at your summer use and building in a surcharge based upon that increased volume of water with municipalities. We anticipate that this would generate $330,000 of revenue for each year of the biennium. We would be looking to take those revenues and use them for additional water resource planning and education and conservation usage done by the Division of Water.
Madam Chair, if I could, the actual fee is based on the total water use, not just the January use. But what we see is a increase in use in the summer of 2 to 4 times what the use is in January. So the surcharge is looking at applying to that heavier summer use, the amount that it exceeds the January use.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, how do we know that that money is going to go be directed towards sustainability studies? What studies are you talking about this increase in funds being directed towards these studies?
Madam Chair, Representative, basically what's been identified as a growing trend and need is the ability to look at water use and the sustainability issues throughout the state. So, what we've identified, if this new money comes in, we would use it. There are some unmet needs, looking at more aggressive water conservation and more aggressive analysis and looking at sustainability. We had a small amount of money directed towards a sustainability study for groundwater last year that we're in the process of finalizing a report, but we did a number of things with that money. And what it points out is the need to be proactive and to look at those issues. Specifically, in this document, it doesn't direct, there's nothing that says exactly where that money is going, but it's an unmet need that we would direct the money towards water conservation and sustainability.
Follow-up?
That says under key measures, the increase in funds directed towards sustainability studies. So it's not going towards sustainability studies?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it is. And water conservation efforts, both.
Director Lacasmo, can I just interject? How can we be sure?
Madam Chair, it's our intent and our testimony that that's where the money is going to go. I expect that we can come back at next year or 2 years from now and account for how that money was spent, and you can show it, or you could have specific language that directs it. But right now, it would be directed towards the department, and that's our intended use.
Representative Johnson, do you have further questions? Representative Bugini?
No, but to follow up to your question, would we be getting a report from you with this money in a year to say some of the things that are going on in the aquifer that we all, not we all, but that when you're here, that we use? What will we get out of this that we can look at and give us some clues about what's going on?
I'm Director Locke.
Madam Chair, Representative Bugini. We are certainly more than willing to report on how we spend the money and the results from those expenditures. Whether or not we could specifically say on a given aquifer what's happening, we can tell you the investigations that are going on and what we see. Typically, what we've seen is there's a lot. We have 750 observation wells in the state, but we don't have an observation well in every aquifer, even in every county, because there's a lot more demand, and we certainly have that. We'd be looking at the growth areas of the state where there's potential for problems, but absolutely we can report to this committee and any others on the results of what we find. And we're in the process of finalizing the report for the $50,000 that was directed to sustainability last year. And we basically did three primary things. One was to drill a new observation well in the Otsego area where there was a gap in data. Second was to have the USGS look at recharge studies, because you need to know how much water is going into the system so you can evaluate how much it's safely, if you're able to safely remove. And thirdly, just to have a discussion among water managers and develop a report on what sustainability means and where are the gaps in needed data. And we're finalizing that now.
Follow-up, Representative Bikini.
Yes. There was a report on NPR last week about contamination in a Cottage Grove area and from old 3M waste discharges. And one of the issues, apparently, is whether that waste is getting into the aquifer. Can you talk to us about that?
Director.
Madam Chair, Representative Bouguinius, I don't really know that. I didn't hear that report, and I don't know the exact details. But certainly, as you have, you know, that's one of the problems with groundwater is you do end up sometimes contaminating those sources, and the money, if the water can't be treated adequately, then it's lost for use. So, I mean, that does happen throughout the state. Specifically, I don't know the details on the Cottage Grove and 3M.
Representative Bouguinius.
Well, thank you. I think that one would be an important one for us to understand because as folks are looking at the wells, I think they have, there are a number of suburban communities. I think Woodbury, Oakdale, a number of suburban communities. So this has to be a fairly large area and over what I would assume is the aquifer that serves all of us in the metro area. And so I think it's important that we understand if there is containment, if it's sufficient, or if it isn't.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bouguinius. Yeah, that's a good point. And I know from the Riley Tar area in St. Louis Park, I know the city of Edina is replacing a well because one of the wells closest to that is now they're seeing VOCs, volatile organic compounds in their chest. So they are relocating a well or putting in a new well and stop using the one that's closest to that. So there is migration of some of even though Riley Carr is being maintained and they have a lot of you know, they're pumping the water and treating it at the Riley Tar site, but there's still a migration off-site. So we will, I'll look into that and give some information back to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Director Lagasmal, is it a single aquifer under the Twin Cities area and suburbs? Is it one aquifer?
Madam Chair, no, there's multiple aquifers, and it depends on where you are in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The big aquifer is the Prairie du Chien Jordan, which extends from basically Maple Grove down through southeastern Minnesota. But there are multiple levels of aquifer, depending on where you are.
And could I also ask about how far down is that aquifer? Are most of the aquifers?
The Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer, Madam Chairman, is about 900 feet below the surface. And that's the bottom one. There's multiple above that.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
Madam Chair, members, if there's no further questions on that change item, we'll move to the next. Yep, Madam Chair, that's on page 67. Members, we are looking here at water permit fee increases. There are four specific fee increases that we are recommending. Again, as with the first three, that I'll talk about, these are pass-throughs. Pass-throughs that we collect the fees. They are deposited into the general fund. The first one is permit application fee. Different instances.
Those permit applications are for work in protected waters or appropriation of waters, both activities that we permit.
Okay. And Madam Chair, members, this one has not been increased since 1988. That was the last time this fee had been increased. We're recommending with these particular ones that they be raised just to keep pace with where we are in inflationary increases. They do not come back to the department.
Deputy Commissioner and or Director Lockesmull, I see this over and over again where fees were established and never increased, and all of a sudden we're increasing them, and a fee is a tax, is a fee is a tax, a surcharge. And why weren't they increased in that duration? It doesn't make sense to me. And if it doesn't make sense to me, it probably doesn't make sense to Minnesota. I don't know if anybody can answer it. I know.
Madam Chair, for a variety of reasons, fees were established for a particular use, for a particular activity. At that snapshot in time, the legislature has decided in the majority of these cases to keep control of those fees and raise them as they see fit. There has not ever been an established schedule for fees to be increased across the board, and requires the legislature to come in and change those statutory languages that they've set up. There have been years where no fees have been, where fees were proposed to increase and never been increased. I remember times in the legislature where that occurred, and all of a sudden, after years and years and years, you get to the point of the necessity to raise them, like not raising it since 1988. It just seems logical that at some point they be adjusted or readjusted.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you explain a little bit more detail the Roman numeral number 3 about the agricultural irrigators and wild rice producers? Current fee, and what are they going to be expected to pay in the future?
Madam Chair, if you want us to skip from 2 down to 3, we can do that, or do you want to wait for that? You want to step right into 3? That's fine.
Junkie, it's your call.
Step right in.
All right. Madam Chair, members, what you're dealing with here is the agriculture irrigators. They have a fee for the use or the permit application for that. We are recommending that you eliminate the language that says the minimum use permit, which means if they declare that they don't use their permit, which is a minimum of $20. Everyone pays $101 up front. If they claim that they don't use it, they default to $20. Out of the 6,000-some-odd permits we issue, we're dealing with 500-600 who claim that non-usage. It's more of a administrative issue.
Madam Chair, is that an annual fee?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. There's an annual water use fee, and there's right now existing statutory language that says the minimum fee if an irrigator would use no water or was suspended for more than 7 consecutive days, they could pay this minimum of $20. And without that language, the minimum would be the minimum for all other users of $101.
Madam Chair,
Representative Junkie,
is that per pivot, per well?
Director Lockesmull.
Madam Chair, it's per system. Typically, on individual pivots, if they aren't directly connected to other pivots, it is a permit for each pivot. Yes.
Representative Bugina.
If we're jumping ahead, let me help with some context here. These fees that you're collecting go into the general fund. In many cases, we are being told by DNR that it would be a good idea to have the fees come in to directly pay for the service in a fund. And you have argued that that makes sense in certain areas. But in this area, we are not seeing the same structure, I don't think, that we are just raising fees, the money goes into the general fund. We don't have a sense of, or I don't have a sense of, maybe everybody else does, do these water fees pay for the actual permitting and the costs to this group in the agency?
Director Lacasmo, or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, this chart that's on the screens shows in the red the cost for public waters protection and water supply management. So that's both of the permit programs. And it's $3.7 million. And with the fee increase that we made in 2003, last session, we generate $3.8 million in revenue with the water use fees and the other permit fees. So right now, with the fee increases that were passed last year, they're paying for directly for the permitting programs. There are parts in the blue part of this chart. That's where we do the gauging and the observation wells and the technical groundwater studies. So it generally is covering all of the costs, or close to.
Follow up.
Yes. Or close to it.
Close to it. Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius. Because we don't have shown is all, if there's a well interference, we have to do a pump test. We have all kinds of other groundwater experts and the groundwater monitoring system. All of those costs are not totally caught in the red section of this pipe chart.
One more, Representative Virginia.
Thank you. Should not the sustainability costs be in here and paid for by this fee?
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, it certainly is logical to look at it that way. We've been all general fund funded, and the fees go to the general fund, not directly to the division. So we haven't had a dedicated. If it were a dedicated source, absolutely, but it hasn't been a dedicated source. And those discussions haven't yielded a dedicated source when we've had them in the past.
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you for your patience, Chair. I'm just trying to follow this process myself on the relationship between these fee increases and water resources management, since that's such a big issue this year, this public waters. And I'm still not quite clear on fact that we're increasing fees, but it's going to the general fund. So is it going to water resource management? It's not going there directly, obviously. And how come it's not? How come we don't just pay for these programs with these permit increases instead of get shipped to the general fund instead and then over to the DNR? How does that happen exactly?
Director Lacasmo.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. It's kind of an argument whether or not you have the a direct appropriation, so the fees go directly to the program, versus do they go to the general fund, and then in the general appropriations process, I get general fund money. It's 90% general funds that supports the Division of Waters. So the money is getting there, but it's not directly through a dedicated fee. And it's kind of a chicken and egg argument on which way you want to fund that. There are certainly general public values for the programs for waters, because waters are important to all Minnesotans. Even though they may not be paying a permit fee, they're paying other taxes or other ways to support those fees. And it's been, so then the general fund has supported this program for water protection. So you can argue it both ways. I mean, there's a benefit being in a dedicated fund. Certainly when we're looking at general fund shortfalls and reductions that are attached to that. I've argued those points in the past, and it's never been accepted. So the system that we have right now is what we have, unless you're a deputy commissioner Olson. follow-up.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, it comes from, with all the different fees that are out there, all the different licenses and permits that are out there, the general consensus is direct activity. You raise a license, you have a license, you have a fee, those fees be dedicated to or directly related to that specific activity. Boat water fees associate to boat water enforcement and acquisition of the lake. Can you make an argument for water use fees, water permit fees, and general conservation work? You can, I guess, but I think that's where the... It's more of a historical than an actual of why it is today. Why is it presented this way? It's because that's the way it kind of always has been. We could make that argument. We could definitely move in that direction.
And Madam Chairman, Representative Johnson, only it was just recently where the revenues probably have started to match the expenses. 5 years ago, it was, you know, you were collecting maybe 25 or 40% of the revenue that to cover the actual expenses, so you wouldn't have been able to fully support a program. Now it's getting a little closer.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Well, just a comment. If we're going to fund budgets now by fee increases, it just seems to make sense to dedicate it and direct it towards the things we're charging extra money for. And given the high profile of water resource management, it just seems like an obvious direction to be heading.
Continue.
Madam Chair, members, the one that we passed over was item number two. That is the once-through cooling fee. This is where water is appropriated out of the aquifer and passed through for the reasons of cooling, either for industrial use cooling or through air conditioning, basically. In the buildings. Water use fees were increased in 2003, however, once through cooling fees were not. And so we are making that recommendation that these be brought up to that standard that was done last year.
Deputy Commissioner, how many are there when we talk about these systems?
There. Madam Chair, there's about less than 100 remaining now. We're in the process. The 1989 Groundwater Act required that they be converted by 2010. So as you can see on the chart that's in your packet and here, this is the quantity of water, not the number of systems. The number of systems are declining and will decline and get... Most of them will stop using water by 2010. The ones that are smaller than 5 million gallons can continue, and there are some exceptions that have been made legislatively, so there are a couple things that would continue.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Cornish, do you want to ask a question? I don't know.
I'd love to.
Oh.
Madam Chair, Director Lagesmo, the ethanol plants, which water appropriation do they use? Do they use the coolant one? And a typical 50 million gallon ethanol plant that they're building right now, like the one on Lake Crystal, with this fee increase for these water appropriations, how much would that raise it per year? You got any idea?
Madam Chairman, Representative Cornish, I believe the only fee increase that we're talking about here that would directly affect them would be the initial permit application fee that goes from $75 to $150. That's a one-time application fee. The other fees for their water use were set last year, and that would be based on the quantity that's used, but they aren't once-through cooling. They're just using the water in their industrial processing. So the once-through cooling fees that we're talking about are predominantly downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul.
continue.
Madam Chair, members, the next or last item, item number four, is not a fee increase. This is a recommendation to shift a $10,000 basically fee or permit that is currently being generated and deposited in the general fund. This is dealing with underground storage of natural gas with CenterPoint Energy that generates $10,000 a year. We're recommending that be instead of deposited into the general fund, it be doing exactly what Representative Johnson is talking about, is shifting that activity to the Division of Waters to cover the expenditures costs for field inspections, monitoring, and analysis of that particular underground storage facility.
Madam Chair, it's a fee that CenterPoint pays now for the monitoring of that system. They have 5 billion cubic feet of gas stored under the ground down by Waseca, and you need to monitor that to make sure it stays where it's intended to stay. And so they pay for the consultant to analyze the details of that and for obtaining all of the samples. Minagasco, so the cost to Minagasco or CenterPoint doesn't change. Check still comes into DNR. The only change is what we do with it. Instead of depositing it in the general fund and not directly paying for the services, it would directly pay for the services.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, the only other thing to add, maybe for Representative Junkie's question, the irrigation fee, there's about 600 that typically claim that, so the additional revenue is $48,000. I mean, that's the kind of number that we're looking at in that category.
But Director Locsmo, do I understand right that they have in the past, and they will again pay $101 up front, but if they do not use this, they used to get it back except for $20? Or am I understanding this wrong? Now they pay $101.
Madam Chair, there's a water use fee required of every water appropriation permit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about 6,700 permits. Mm-hmm. So each of those permits is responsible for a fee based on a schedule of fees. And the fee for under 50 million gallons a year right now is $101. And a center pivot irrigation system, for example, uses about 43 million gallons a year. So all of the irrigation systems, virtually all, hit the minimum fee of $101. Right now, if they use no water, they can pay a minimum fee of $20. If we would make this change, delete that section from law, they would pay the minimum fee of $101.
Any questions? Okay, continue.
Okay, members, that concludes the division.
Is that, excuse me, is that a no use still pay idea?
Madam Chair, no.
Oh, okay, thank you.
There is a value in having an appropriation permit in an irrigation system on the property. I mean, there's a value because that exists.
Continue.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, we'll be moving into the Division of Forestry.
Before you move into there, could just for my understanding, on page 65 with the one change item with APO, that's a surcharge, you said. A surcharge rate? Page 65 on the APOs, and when you talked about it, you said a surcharge. Yes or no?
Madam Chair, yes, it's a surcharge.
A surcharge? You want to define that for me and why we're calling it.
Madam Chair, yes. They would pay the regular fee based on the quantity of water used. And under the fee schedule, that ranges from the minimum we just talked about with agriculture. And beyond that, it goes up to $6.50 per million gallons. So the surcharge is an additional fee of $20 per million gallons based on the difference in the water used in those 3 months versus the water used in January. So you would calculate that volume, whatever that is, and apply this additional $20 to that additional volume.
Thank you. Before we go on, we have a forum, and let's approve the minutes. And Representative Hoppe has been studying them instead of listening. So,
they're well written, Madam Chair.
Okay, would you like to move those?
I would love to move them.
Okay, Representative Hoppe moves them.
Lots of pictures.
Minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Again? Minutes are moved. Continue.
Okay, thank you, members, Madam Chair. The next one is the Division of Forestry. Director Mike Carroll will be doing a division overview for you. Yesterday we announced that Director Carroll will be leaving the Division of Forestry in a couple of months and taking over the duties of Regional Director of the Northwest Region in Bemidji. So that is going to be a next year a new face in this area. Division of Forestry, but a new face up in the Northwest region.
Well, welcome to our area, Mr. Carroll. I hope you get along well.
I'm delighted to be heading back up into that country.
I know you're known up there, so.
Well, that's not necessarily.
No, I mean positively.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'll give you a brief overview, and then we'll spend time on the budget and some of the changes. Again, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry, you have a packet there, and we'll go over again Minnesota Forest Land Ownership. We always cover this again because forest management in the state is a cooperative effort with many different owners of the state, the county, federal, which includes tribal land ownerships. The tribes do have active forest management programs, and private sector, which in this particular case includes the industrial and small non-industrial woodland owners. Again, 40%, 42% of the base there, so that is the need for outreach and cooperation with those landowners. You can see the trend in Minnesota forest land from 1850 to current. We still are blessed as a state with a great acreage of intact forests in the state. That's one of our clear legacies for future generations. What do we do as a Division of Forestry? We protect people, property, and natural resources from wildfire. We manage 4.5 million acres of state forest lands for multiple uses, again, multiple values. We help landowners and communities restore and improve forests. We have both rural and urban forestry programs to assist landowners and communities manage their trees. Very active with a cooperative here in the metro between the university, state and private, and the cities themselves in doing urban forestry. We do have two nursery facilities where we produce conservation grade seedlings for low cost reforestation efforts, and we implement the policies of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, and again in cooperation with the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. We as a division have taken the mandate of priorities and some downsizing on our staff. We have done that over a period of time. We continue to respond where our focus is to try to maintain field capability, and where we have to take structural reductions, we're trying to do that in our overhead and our supervisory positions. Again, critical forest trends in the state that you deal with almost on a daily basis with this committee and many of your constituents, again, is land use change. The greatest loss is, contrary to some people think, is not from forest management. We retain the forest base through forest management, but we do lose forest acres due to residential development, subdivisions, those types again. And the tract size in the private sector is decreasing. We do have more wildfire risk. We work very cooperatively with our rural fire departments, our city fire departments, as one of our greatest outreach programs in cooperation with rural fire departments. But we do have challenges there in wildfire risk, reduced forest quality in some cases for habitat, clearly for recreational access, those types of things are a real challenge for us. Ecosystem health is on the top of our multiple use management list. We do have increasing threats in the state from non-native invasive species. We do see some fluctuations in our climate. We are under change, and we are preparing to, again, cooperatively deal with those influences. Increasing fragmentation of forest land and decreasing habitat size is occurring throughout the state. One of the current operations that the legislature has agreed upon, and we are getting some funding through LCMR, is for third-party certification of state forest land management in the state. This audit provides our consumers continued access to the worldwide markets and documents what we have been, quote, certifiable, as I say, for years. We have had certified forestry in Aiken County since the early 90s, but we are going to go statewide again to both assure our publics that we do a sustainable forest management job, to improve our business practices, and to allow our consumers to sell into third-party certified markets. Forest-based economics and recreation, as many of you know, most of our industry now is a global industry, not a lot of local ownership. So the decisions made in Minnesota have to balance against decisions made in other portions of the world, and we would like to keep, for forest management reasons, multiple use reasons, we would like to keep the capital investment in our forest industry here in the state so that we can upgrade and stay on the edge of consumers, not only for the jobs and the multipliers in the economy, but to allow us to manage our forests. Increasing recreational demand is one of the clearest challenges of our state forest system. The public wants access to the state forest, and how they get that access, be it motorized, non-motorized, hunting, fishing, bird watching, those types of things, is a clear challenge to manage the very diverse expectations of the public in using their state forest land. You've been given an overview in the past on the conservation agenda, but we in forestry are very tied to indicators and performance targets. We rate ourselves and our expenditures on what we can accomplish with the dollars we get from the public trust. We do offer wood for sale from state lands, and that generates an excess of $20 million in revenue back to the state. We do reforest. By law, we are required to reforest any acreages harvested in the state. Our inventory process gives us current information for extensive planning operations. We are a large fire organization. We respond only ourselves to 16,000 wildfires. Again, not as many as the rural fire departments respond to, but we work cooperatively with them in equipment and training to make sure that response as well. I mentioned our tree seedlings. Again, a very strong interaction with the private sector. There's a very strong tension there, give and take, on what we produce, what they produce, and how we provide conservation-grade seedlings to the public for reforestation. We do assist small woodland owners and do forest stewardship plans, again, in cooperation with the private sector, consultants, and the soil and water conservation districts. And again, we are heavily involved in the inventory and designation of the OHV roads and trails on 56 state forests.
Director Carroll?
Yes,
ma'am. On the reforestation, what's the... how about private companies that are... Is there a requirement that they reforest too?
We don't have a legal requirement under a Forest Practices Act, but industry, the counties, and other landowners have more than stepped up to the plate in reforestation because it is a critical reinvestment priority for their business. The counties are very much online. The tribes are online in this, but clearly for industry, it is a very high priority for them, not only for the economic value of the fiber that's produced, the intense investment, but also for the recreational value of their property. So they see it. They reap benefits from that also. So we in the state are very, very well blessed with a very active forest industry and county operations that do that.
Thank you.
DNR timber sales, again, we offer. There's always, with the limited sales on federal land in the state and counties have stepped up and offered very sustainable levels. I want you to make sure you understand these are sustainable levels of harvest, but this is very important not only for the rural part of our economy, but also over 60% of the employment in the forest industry in the state is in the metro and suburban ring with secondary processing, those types of things. So we're very committed, again, to sustainable forest management. We do use our ecological classification systems to assist us in setting up and monitoring our timber sales. Forest certification, as I mentioned, this is a business decision to improve our business practices, to allow our customers to understand that we are a sustainable operation, and to allow our consumers to remain competitive in the global market. Again, very important, and very. This is a key. This is one of the things I've waited my whole career for, and I'm very delighted with our staff in stepping up to the plate on ecological classification systems. This is a further use of vegetative and site information to refine our forest management, to retain biodiversity, and also improve productivity on our sites. And the legislature and LCMR have been very supportive of this effort, and we are seeing a very good response to this in use in the field. Private landowner stewardship, again, is our outreach. These are basically outreach to the small woodland owners that do not have either the technical expertise themselves or a large enough property to employ a private consultant. And we do this cooperatively. Again, some our staff do, but a lot is done with private sector vendors and then also the soil and water conservation districts. The LCMR funding we are provided to do this is pass-through money to increase accomplishments. It's not an infrastructure gain for us. This is the area of private landowner stewardship where we are taking cuts in our budgets. We have a rather complex budget set up within the Division of Forestry, and I'll cover that briefly, and then I have specifics, and I can answer questions there. If you see again, basically our general funding, you see the number there, $65.3 million. Under our general fund, this is general operations, which include things like timber management, forest development, state land, survey, those types of things. It includes our systems development with our computer systems, forest management information systems. It includes both our general and open fire appropriations. They are general fund dollars. And it includes money for the Minnesota Forest Resources Council that is passed through from our operation. If you see the corner on special revenue fund, this includes a pass-through of CONCON payments to the counties. It includes a Forest Roads gas tax, an aerial photo account, cooperative survey. We do a lot of work with the NRCS and the NCRS, National Conservation Groups, to review inventory practices and procedures. This is the Minnesota Interagency Fire Cooperative is here under special revenues. Out-of-state fire, we are a leader in fire aviation expertise. The CL-215s, our aircraft, do go out-of-state with staff, and we are paid back for those operations, and money is there. The forest nursery account I mentioned is a special self-sustaining a revolving account that operates the nursery. The nursery has to operate on the receipts of its operation, so it is sustaining. And then there are other things here in special revenues, like we charge for tree planters. We upgrade those tree planters, allow private people to rent those tree planters, a variety of different things. Federal surplus equipment, we will bring it in, refurbish it, and then give it out to the fire departments. They all fit under the special revenue fund. Under federal dollars, which you see is a rather large amount there, the majority of this is pass-through dollars, community fire grants, grants to local fire departments, special projects in urban and forest health, the FireWise program, which is an outreach with the rural and local fire departments to help people make their homes safe from wildfire, those types of things, they all fit under some of the federal grants. The Environment and Natural Resources funding there listed at $1.7 million, which basically is are the LCMR dollars. They include pass-through dollars for legacy. That is one of the things we're going to do, which is a match to buy and retain public access to private industrial lands. That's a legacy program. It, again, is pass-through dollars to accomplish more stewardship plans. It is some dollars to start up the certification program, and dollars for the Minnesota Relief Program, which are passed through to suburban and urban communities for tree planting, tree inventories, and forest health within those communities. So I've covered those. The $0.5 million under Game and Fish, again, are the targeted dollars for the ecological classification system. Those are the only targeted dollars we get out of that account to deal with, again, our ecological, with very strong support from our Ecological Services Division. A lot of help from their staff and other cooperators from private industry. Very strong ECS use in private industry. So that is the overview. I can come back if there's more detailed questions, but the last slide I have is on our legislative initiatives, and it's basically the first one is exactly what I finished up on. Oh, you want to come
Okay. Members, any questions for the director on forestry?
Representative Bugina.
Well, thank you. You used the word sustainable and reforestation, and I'm, you know, pleased with the words. I just, one thing just keeps popping in my mind, and that is that we have a native butternut that are decreasing. They're gorgeous wood. I understand that there are strains that are being developed that don't carry the fungus.
That's correct.
And I would hope that we would, as part of forestry, start introducing those back into our system as part of our reforestation, and that you all would take the leadership on that.
Director Farrell.
Madam Chairman, Representative Lagenius, we are active in that program. I personally have marked butternut throughout the range of Minnesota to try to retain those trees that show some resistance naturally. We have contributed seed sources from throughout the state to the federal, they call it a reinvigoration program. It's a widespread problem. Our state forest nursery program grows butternut to retain native seed sources of butternut. We have done plantings of those on state land, but the disease is very widespread, and the two federal projects with which we cooperate, number one is definitely a breeding program to try to identify and establish those resistant strains. One of the key questions we have there, there's a little more detail, but one of the questions is, in the breeding program, there is a Japanese walnut that to the common person, you can't tell the difference between an American walnut or a Japanese walnut. We can cross those. It does show resistance. But then you have the question of, even though it's a half, is it a native species or is it not? So that is available as a drop back if we may do that in some urban settings just to reintroduce the butternut in some urban settings, because that's not, quote, a natural site. But the other program with the breeding within the federal program, those projects continue, and as different family groups are brought out for screening, the state will include and do some of those outplantings. It's a wonderful woodworking, it's a wonderful wildlife habitat tree, and it's just a beautiful tree. So we are involved in that project.
Well, thanks. I had heard that you weren't, so that's encouraging.
I collected the nuts, and I grew them, and I know we've got some outplanted. So the federal projects are being cut, but we continue to supply material to those programs for breeding. And the federal, we are trying to make sure that the federal hardwood project at Purdue University in Indiana does keep that butternut project. We are on the edge of the range for butternut, and we are the only state that has a butternut white pine climax, which is just a wonderful tree mix. And you see it on the Gull Lake and on the Mississippi River, and we are trying to retain those genetics in the program.
Thank you. If you show this passion with your butternuts, I'm sure they'll continue. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Carroll, when you showed that slide on private landowner stewardship,
yes,
you said that was an area where you're taking cuts.
It is.
Can you say a little bit more about that and what that means?
Within the division, we have three major priorities. Our first, of course, is health and safety through fire prevention. Our second priority is estate land management. And the third priority is with cooperators to continue to do stewardship outreach and assist in technical assistance for private landowners. As the budgets have shrunk and as priorities have been established within government, the Division of Forestry, a general fund agency, has said, these are your percentages of the general fund cuts. Where would you take those? And this, although it is one of my favorite programs, you get a lot of strokes from dealing with the non-industrial private landowners. They are very interested people. This is an area where offloads to the private sector are going to have to pick up the slack, and this is an area where we basically, given budget reductions, this is an area where we have directed those cuts. Did I answer your question? It's not a preference, it's a reality of trying to prioritize what we do as a state agency.
Representative.
Madam Chair, what exactly does that entail working with the private landowners? What are you talking about? What do you do?
What's
not going to get done, I guess?
Well, what the concern is, obviously, 42% of the ownership in the state is industrial. A lot of that is small private woodland owners. Some of you are woodland owners. They when people buy the property, they usually come in and say, this is my preserve, I'm going to protect it forever. After 3 or 4 years, they realize the forest changes. Mother Nature makes change. I need some assistance on my water quality. I want to improve my wildlife habitat. Those are the two first things. The third question they ask is, well, you know, maybe I should cut some of this timber. How do I do that properly? How do I reforest it after I cut? So we get private people that come to our offices, because we interact with them on so many programs, and they ask for technical assistance. How do I better do a better job of managing my woodlot? And in the past, we had staff and dollars dedicated. This legislative body and LCMR provided dollars to actually accelerate that outreach, to provide very strongly supported in the environmental community, because they want to see good technical assistance for wildlife management, ecoservices, those types of things on private lands. But that is one of the areas where we are taking a cut, and the hope is that the private sector will pick up some of that work and provide that technical assistance. What happens is, just being the larger ownerships where there is an economic return for a private consultant to pick up that work, and they do good work, I'm not saying they don't, they do it, they will pick up those larger parcels where they, as a private individual, and then the smaller people, the 40 to 20 acres and stuff, are kind of left saying, well, I would like some assistance, but where do I go? And we work very closely with the soil and water conservation districts to try to get them assistance. But this is an area where, because of reduced resources, we are stepping away and not doing as much, and hoping that our cooperators will pick it up. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Okay. Deputy Commissioner, do you have some change items for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. Members, I'd ask you to turn to page 84 of your budget. That begins, actually, I'm going to go right into page 85, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, this is the spreadsheet that deals with the Division of Forestry. As Director Carroll has talked about and has shown you through the slides, we've been making some changes, some management changes. The division was more heavily dependent upon general fund over previous bienniums. We've been slowly maneuvering and making some policy changes and creating some new opportunities to diversify their funding. As Director Carroll talked about, this is a very important division in terms of the economy in Minnesota, the activities they do for conservation and protection of the land and citizens. But unfortunately, due to their large general fund allocation and dependency upon it, you see a larger concentration of general fund reductions here than you do within other divisions who have little general fund activity. As you see here in the budget page, when we get to the governor's recommendations, we are recommending a $1.1 million reduction a year, or $2.3 million from this division from general fund reduction. Members, I will tell you that the area that we are focusing in on as we prioritize, some of these will be coming from activities or suspended activity that we did from the 05 budget year. This current fiscal year and the changes that we had talked about last year. One of those particularly is in the Northeast, the blowdown. When the blowdown occurred in the Boundary Waters Canoe area, there was a lag time between when the feds became fully engaged and fully staffed. Minnesota DNR reacted, and Minnesota legislature reacted immediately and began deploying and getting contracts with local units for fire protection up in that area. As the years have gone on after that blowdown, the presence and the full implementation of the federal response has now come into place. We are pulling back and have pulled back dramatically from that arena. Predominantly or specifically in the area of helicopter contracts. So that has already occurred or been eliminated, those savings. We have also implemented in the 05 year core reduction programs, and that is what some of the things that Director Carroll has talked about, but also achieving savings from other things like attorney general costs and fleet reduction. Fleet reduction within the Division of Forestry is very high, as you can imagine. You're dealing with very large equipment in some areas. The diversity of work that they do, requires a very large and very diverse fleet, from very heavy equipment and equipment that can enter into fog and wetland areas during fire season, but then just actual utilization of trucks to move people during their other work duties. So, but we've been a very aggressive in the area of fleet, and there, this has been also some savings that has occurred. But then also in the area that cooperative forest management that Director Carroll has talked about. So those three areas of focus has been where we have focused in those general fund reductions to this division. If there's any questions on that, I would ask you to move then to forest the change items. We begin those change items. The first one is actually, again, back in the front of your book, page 12, dealing with heritage enhancement. Again, as we talked about on Tuesdays, we walked through that graph and that of lottery in lieu and the distribution of funds. 50% of it is deposited into the Game and Fish Fund. Last biennium, we had made a recommendation for some money to be appropriated from that particular account within the Game and Fish Fund to the Division of Forestry for ecological classification system, or allow us to develop that, allow us to go into the forest, identify, map what is actually out there for the types of plants that occur there, allows us to plan and implement what types of trees, what types of plants should be planted in specific areas. It's one of those things that we started last biennium, and we're requesting that appropriation of $250,000 a year to continue in the next biennium. Members, if there's no questions there, then we're going to turn to page 44 from the budget book. Members, you have heard a number of bills in this committee, DNR policy / finance bills, individual bills. This is one that we had brought to you last biennium, and I believe you may have already looked at it this year. This is dealing with the operation of electronic burning permits. We are looking to make a change, or not really looking to make a change, but we're trying to evolve our fire permit system as we currently use it in the state, and bring it into the electronic age, allowing citizens to have multiple points of access through their traditional fire wardens that are located throughout your community, but also for those individuals who wish to have a little diversity and buy permits over a period of time, they can go through the electronic licensing system. This is a long-term change that we are looking to bring in. I believe you have heard this bill in the committee. But it generates an $80,000 a year to cover the cost of the ELS system. There's no questions on that.
Excuse me. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am sorry. I must have been not in committee when this bill was presented, because I have just one fundamental question. I mean, I think it's great you're going to electronic burning permits. That makes total sense to me. But the expenses in the paper permits, not in the electronic permits, yet we're charging for the electronic permits, and the paper ones will be free.
Do you want to address that or try?
Madam Chair, Representative Lagenius, I guess the simple answer to that is culture and tradition. Do you want to try to justify that?
I think that we have a very dedicated core of fire wardens. Many of them are along in years, and they've established a very good clientele. They've done a phenomenal job for us in our outreach and a lot of our prevention work in areas. So when we looked at this program, over time, the reliance on paper permits will decline. as people, just more people come online and are more comfortable doing it. But we did not want to, I'll say it very well, we did not want to insult the dedication of those people that have done the work in the past. We wanted to do a transition over a period of time. And that's, you are right on track where the cost is. But it is a cultural change over time, and we don't want to give any discredit to the people who have done a phenomenal job and still do a phenomenal job through the paper permit. So that we are, it is definitely a change balance that we are trying to carry off.
Madam Chair, Representative Allegheny, so it is also recognizing that I think probably when fire permit requirements were brought in, that was probably one of the, I don't even know when that would have been, 1930s, that was probably one of those political decisions that were made by the to create, require people to get a permit for burning of stuff that they've always done and didn't believe they needed a permit for, but to enter into a regulated environment. My guess is the legislature probably determined that that should be free and that we need the cost. That was probably why.
It is definitely an outreach and prevention tool that over the years has served us very well. And it's the transition that we need to carry out.
Follow up?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I guess my experience with burning permits is just very different than the one you're telling me about, and that is you just go into the DNR office and we get them for a whole season, but then are told that if we're going to burn, you have to call the fire department, the volunteer fire department, let them know. Is that part and parcel of everybody's requirement that you call the fire department and let them know?
Not unless it gets away.
Pardon?
It is.
Not unless it gets away. And then you call the fire department.
It is our desire that the future system, both with the paper permits and the electronics, does give us a more comprehensive view of when people are burning and where. We are not there yet. This is a move towards that. And in some parts of the state, we already have that requirement and compliance with notifying the dispatcher for the fire department. It's because with cell phones now, it's usually the county sheriff that gets the call first, not the fire department. But we are working towards coordinating that. That's where we're headed.
Thank you.
Very different. Yeah, it is very different. And we usually have a fire warden, probably within a township out there that we know, and he can look outside and see if the weather is right. And there's a trust level there, at least I think in my area and maybe others, where I realize that you can tell the weather over the internet, but a lot of people aren't sure that that really is the case. So, Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witnesses. Is this internal or is this contracted out? What is to be the $80,000 for the burning permits is to set up this computer system? Are you doing that internally, or are you putting out RFPs and contracting it out?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, we'll be going through the electronic license system that we currently have for game and fish. That is a contract service that we, I believe it's out of Missouri, who developed the system for game and fish activity, and we'll just incorporate this permit into that program.
And, Madam Chair, I guess I have no basis for this at all. I'm just curious on the cost. I mean, $80,000 a year, I keep thinking in my mind, boy, I'd like to, I think even I could probably set up a website for $80,000 a year and contract it out. I mean, it seems like a lot to be adding to a vendor. That's one full-time person, basically, FTE at a, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 salary plus benefits, $80,000. Boy, I would sure think we could hire someone for that would run that permit process only and probably wouldn't be working 8 hours a day. So it just seems a little high to me is all. Or is that just an estimate on your part now until you actually get a RFP out and see what it is?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, to be clear, this isn't a web page development access over the internet. You're going to be going to your local 7-Eleven or your local bobber shop, bait shop, and using that game and fish license vendor to be your contact person to buy your burning permit.
Madam
so what these costs are associated with is to the structural change and implementation of that system, and the actual cost per unit or per sale, which is about 87 cents, I believe. A transaction cost currently for Game and Fish is about 87 cents a transaction.
So, Madam Chair, I guess that did open up my eyes. I didn't realize that. Why wouldn't we be moving to an internet-based system so I can get it right at home? That's what I thought the ease of this was, not walking into a vendor and paying a vendor to do it, but rather, why can't I do this from my computer at home? I type in where I live, and, you know, it's a whole process, and shouldn't that be the way we move rather than adding more vendors and electronics for this?
This is like our ELS system. I mean, that's what we're using, right?
Madam Chair, yes, this is going into the existing electronic licensing system.
Will we move toward licensing over the internet for whatever license we want to get?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, yes, that is the direction we are ultimately heading over a period of time towards more internet sales. It is a transition that we are headed down that road.
Continue, please.
Madam Chair, then the next item is on page 46. This is one that the committee has also heard, that dealing with special fuel permits. This was the one where it was a minimum charge of $5 or up to the market value of the timber. As we said in the committee, I believe it was last week, we estimate this being a $6,000 revenue generator. And we're done with it. Madam Chair, members, the next item is on page 48. This is also another bill that I know the committee has heard. This is dealing with the nursery stock surcharge. This is the one where we are asking for the ability to increase our surcharge on nursery stock up to 2.5 cents and using those revenues for education and forage stewardship planning. This was the $250,000 based off 2.5 cents surcharge. Members, the next item is on page 50. This is one that we began the last session by creating a dedicated account, forest management account within natural resources account. What we are doing here is recommending that on forest management practices on school trust fund lands, we currently certify our costs to the environmental trust fund or that process there. So the work level that is done on school trust fund lands are certified, and then those costs are associated to the trust fund. Right now you have a three-tier or a triangle pattern where we certify those costs to the environmental trust fund. Environmental trust fund reimburses the general fund, and then the general fund reimburses the Division of Forestry. Through your appropriations, what we are recommending is that this transfer occur be, instead of a triangle relationship, that it be direct between certified management costs on school trust fund lands to the trust fund, and then those on school trust fund lands to the trust fund, and then those costs be redistributed back to the Division of Forestry in a more of a direct relationship. We believe this will be a revenue neutral activity, but simplifying that relationship between school trust fund lands, general fund, and the Division of Forestry. There's no questions on that.
Yes. Is there a cost when you cut trees? Does the DNR charge a cost when they cut trees on school trust land? that comes out?
We certify the cost for the inventory work, the timber sale supervision by an hourly. If it's cut on school trust fund land, we keep track of how many hours we are on that acre, how much it takes to set up and supervise the sale. And at the end of the year, under current law, we are allowed to certify those costs. And that is what goes into the suspense account, those costs.
So, Director Carroll, that is then subtracted out of what goes to the school trust.
It's not technically subtracted out, but it does reduce, because it all goes to the same place. But it does, we are then allowed to say, here are our costs, and come back and ask for those dollars to be given back to us. It's procedural. On the surface of it, if you were looking at, yes, we charge for our costs. Yes.
And so on that, it's still state land, only a school trust.
Correct.
So on that state land, there's a cost.
Correct.
On other state forest land, do you do the same thing?
Yes, we do cost code those type of things. Yes,
it's
and that's
kind of all in the same pot.
It's all in the same pot. Correct.
Okay.
But we do keep track by hour how much time it takes us to set up and supervise those sales.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, no other questions for Forestry Division? Okay.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner or Director Carroll, either one. I think we've talked about this last biennium and other times, and Representative Dill probably knows more about this issue than I do. But we have the big airplanes that come in, and are we talking about maybe transitioning or adding to that fleet of aircraft with the Whip Air aircraft that we have made down here in South St. Paul? We've talked about this issue before, and we've been out to see the planes, and is there any talk about moving in that direction?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I'll allow the director to answer that specific question. I do need to come back to this because there is a budgetary item around the air fleet that we need to talk about, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, we are in direct communications with Whip Air. We will put one of their planes under contract this year. It'll actually be under a federal contract, but it will be available for use in Minnesota. We are actively pursuing with our cooperators through the Lake States Forestry Compact to try to get the plane airtime in both Wisconsin and Ontario again. So we are actively involved in getting those planes in the fleet and available for people to use, because we know then they will be requested for specific use. They do not replace the larger scooping aircraft, but they do offer another niche that will be very useful in the Lake States area, and we will help promote that use at both the federal and compact levels. We are looking at specific. They almost had a contract in Wisconsin. They didn't quite get that. They are now redoing some of their bidding for this compact plane that will be used within the Lake States. We talked about it last week at our fire meeting. We are on board. As Representative Dill is very aware, there are a few machine upgrades that are necessary for them to meet federal delivery compliance, but those are definitely attainable, and we will continue to push this as a Minnesota option for people throughout where we have the right water resources. Through our compact agreements, we will push and actually demonstrate this aircraft.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Continue.
Madam Chair, briefly, there is another budgetary reduction that's related to forestry, and that is in the open appropriation. The open appropriation as it relates to fire preparedness. Currently, the Division of Forestry and its fire activity gets a direct appropriation of $7.8 million?
$7.8 million
for preparedness for the upcoming fire season. If we overspend or need to spend more than that in putting out fire, we are allowed to enter into the open appropriation to recover those costs to do fire. Getting back to the planes and how that relationship is, a couple of years ago, 2001, the Department of Natural Resources bought two CL-215s. These are water scooping planes. They're dual-engine water scooping planes that allows to go in, access water and deliver it to the fire on a rapid response. Those payments were obligated payments for the acquisition came out of the debt service, or I'm sorry, from the open appropriation for firefighting. Those payments will be coming off. We'll be making one more payment in the fiscal year 06, and then that debt will be gone. That is a $763,000 savings in 06 and a $1.5 million savings in 07 for the department, or for the general fund open appropriation. I just wanted to bring members' attention to that. Okay, members, if there's no further questions for forestry, then I believe we're moving into fish and wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, Director Dumfries. And state your name, and we can start. We have 15 minutes left in this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Gunther. I'm Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for the time here this morning. I'm going to spend some time giving an overview of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and then we'll talk about our initiatives that are coming up. Just referring to some of the work that the Division of Fish and Wildlife, which is certainly one that many of you find a topic of conversation and interest and have supported historically. To frame the scale of the things that we do, within the division we manage 50 various species through regulated harvest, going from big game, small game, waterfowl, migratory birds, fur bearers. We do that through a system, one that has created, with your support, a large extensive wildlife management area system, 1,355 systems, WMAs, within almost all of our counties. We're missing Rock County. You know, our aquatic management areas, which is near 37,000 acres, we're increasing all the time. We've got 92.5 miles of lakeshore and 523 miles of shoreline that we work to protect. We manage actively 5,400 fishing lakes and 15,000 miles of streams. You see the data on the number of public water accesses and the fishing piers and fishing sites that are available that are compare favorably to anywhere else in the country. We are a hunting and fishing state. We have close to 600,000 hunters and trappers, which ranks us high in the national standings. 2.2 million of our citizens identify themselves as active wildlife viewers. 2.2 million anglers. Tremendous numbers of people that go out. Those are the people that we serve, along with the resort industry and related tourism businesses. One of the things that I would like to mention to you, I think you all hear a lot of suggestions about the department and how the department manages and how we should manage. But I think sometimes we lose the total context of where we are. We are a national leader in virtually every one of our activities. We rank within the top five states as a destination for fishing. Now that's kind of interesting, out of 50 states, that we'd be one of the top five. But I think it becomes even more compelling when you think of the states that we compete with. The coastal states, Florida or Texas, where people, I know we up here, look at going to Florida for a fishing trip for Texas. California certainly has that. Alaska, Oregon, Washington. I mean, well-known fishery states, and yet we rank consistently within the top five. We're either fourth or fifth in the state. The National Rough Grouse Hunt is conducted in Grand Rapids, my hometown. There's a reason that people come here. During an average day during that hunt, we can expect a hunting team to move, meaning either point or flush, somewhere around 20 to 35 birds. if we go out to the classic grouse hunting country, the states of the U.S., such as Maine, they feel very, very fortunate if they move one or two grouse a day. So we score very high. We're probably the best in the country. I don't think anyone would argue that as far as our grouse populations. Maybe Michigan would come close. But you've just finished with Director Carroll. A large part of that is dependent on our forest and the reason that we've got that wealth. We also have, in the last 2 years, our record harvest of white-tailed deer. The deer management may be controversial because it's complex. It's complex because we offer such a great variety to our hunters. They can start in mid-September. They can hunt through the end of the year. They can hunt bucks. They can hunt does. They can hunt with bow, muzzleloader, rifle, or shotgun. They can hunt a long season or a short season. They can hunt bucks only. They can hunt multi-zones. And that leads to a complexity in our game and fish code to try to offer that opportunity. We, within the last couple of years, have offered seasons for prairie chicken, and you gave us a dove season. That's the first time in 60 years that that's occurred. It's very encouraging for everything. We right now are worrying about our waterfowl, what our population is in waterfowl. And we are very concerned about that, and we have this active rally that will be coming on in April. But I should report some of the data that's also associated with Minnesota's harvest for waterfowl. The last years the data is available are in 02 and 03. In those years, Minnesota was number one in the country for harvest of Canada geese. For mallard population, we were number two. In the Mississippi Flyway, we were number two in the country. For waterfowl harvest overall, we were either second or third or fourth, depending on whether that's Mississippi Flyway or it's whether the entire country. So our waterfowl harvest has been up, in spite of the fact that we do have a concern with many of our species of birds. So we are a very active state and are very successful. I've inherited a very successfully managed division, and we should speak to that. Our goals within the division are to conserve and restore fish and wildlife habitat and populations. Most of the things that we'll talk about today have to do with either that initiative or to conduct also our fish and wildlife inventory, research, and monitoring. Those are the things that guide our management principles. Those are the things that guide us in setting those productive harvest quotas that we can have. We've also been working on fish propagation, either through hatchery programs, and we now have a new initiative to work more closely with aquaculture to acquire from them fish for stocking in specific streams and locations. We also work as an agency to provide technical assistance and education. The critical trends, the things that we're terribly concerned about, is habitat loss, our loss of grasslands, wetlands, lakeshores, the things that we see happening in them as we all basically want to love our land to death. We want to move out and take advantage of living on the lake and creating our own atmosphere and pressuring that system to the point that it can't tolerate us. We're concerned about harmful invasive species, wildlife disease. You've shared with us the concern and alarm over the potential of CWD. We're glad to be able to report that we believe that Minnesota is free right now as a result of the heavy and extensive work that we did in our CWD testing. A major change that's taking place in Minnesota. Minnesota has had a well of land available to people to go from any area of the state to hunt or fish or pick berries or travel or simply to enjoy. Those patterns are changing as ownership patterns change. As the timber industry, the forest industry, the paper industries are finding new ways of meeting their bottom lines and are taking lands that have been ours, that people thought they were ours, our destinations to go to hunt, fish, or recreate, and they're now being privatized. They were publicly, or they were privately owned by big corporations, but now they're moving into private hands. And one of the big things that we frequently observe is as that occasion takes place, then the no hunting, no trespassing sign goes up. That changing ownership pattern is going to influence the way our future generations recreate in Minnesota.
We have a question. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question on the critical trends. Would you consider the bioaccumulation of mercury in our fish as a critical trend, or how would you address that within this context?
Director Gunther.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. I'm not the best expert to answer the question, but that is certainly a concern. I think that our Ecological Services Unit will probably address that issue more clearly when they make their presentation. Director Fanmiller is here. There is a concern, certainly, in bioaccumulation. There's a concern from health agencies. We, as an agency, have not detected that enough, but I don't want to place us in juxtaposition to the Department of Health that would be better suited to address that.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Continue, please.
Going through that.
May I ask the question?
Of course. Madam Chair.
Well, no, why am I asking you? I'm the chair. that changing land ownership patterns, you know, it's kind of a loaded gun here because, yes, it's changing ownership. But it was private before. It is private again. I mean, it hasn't changed as far as what type it is. The fact that some will post a no trespassing sign, and you have, you know, and the person has to ask to hunt or whatever. In fact, there's some that have, you know, charge fees. Innovative idea, isn't it, in Minnesota? But, you know, I guess you didn't manage the land, that land before. It was done privately.
Right.
And you probably aren't going to have the budget to manage it in the future. It's a case where we need to work with people just like around this table. Yeah, I know there's a difference, but we have, where do we rank in the 50 states? You gave us a lot of rankings. Where do we rank with public land? That would be helpful if you could come up with that for me.
I know that, Madam Chair, I do know that that information is available, but I've heard different figures on it, and I'm reluctant to cite exactly what it is.
Next time.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I know we're running short of time, and Mr. Gunther will probably have to come back another day.
Okay.
But I think what they're talking about here is the paper product,
yeah,
or the paper companies, and how their land ownership is changing, and it's going to these TMOs, these timber management organizations, and I think that's what they're talking about, and trying to maintain access to those lands, and maybe involving some kind of a permanent access, a permanent easement to those lands, so we can keep hunting on those lands that we're allowed to now. But with the change of ownership and these stock companies buying these paper companies' lands, we're not sure what's going to continue. We're going to continue to have access to those lands for hunting. And I think that's what we're trying to get to under that.
I do too.
Not that the state wants to own those lands, but at least get some kind of an easement to those lands.
And that would be, you know, the best of all situations, because not only would we get some tax dollars off them, but we would also be able to hunt them and come open to the public, and I don't disagree with that. And certainly the other point you brought up about lakeshore ownership and stuff, I know that's getting...
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbart, thank you for your comments, and that is exactly what we're concerned with. And no, emphatically, this is not an intent for the department to acquire the land. It's recognizing a trend that is very concerning to us. We've been very, very fortunate in Minnesota to have this opportunity for virtually all of us just to be able to say we're going up north and be able to go recreate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is on the cusp of changing.
And I think this is a really good point to break for today. And so will you be able to come back
we'll be back
Tuesday morning? And thank you. And with that, the meeting's closed.